Hello, this is Morgan Freeman, and you are listening to Quantitude, the podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. I am very, very pleased to introduce this year's Quantitude holiday episode, but I don't want to give anything away. So put on your pajamas, throw another log on the fire, and let Patrick and Greg be the warm cup of cocoa for your soul. And where are the donuts? Patrick said there would be donuts. I like the ones with the sprinkles on them. Did you know that in some places they call sprinkles jimmies? Although that's mostly when they're on ice cream. And in some countries they put sprinkles on bread. I find that so interesting.
Morgan, will you get on with it?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm sorry. Well, $100 is $100. So welcome to this year's Quantitude holiday episode.
Dude, I love that somehow you got Morgan Freeman to voice over this, but this is not holiday music.
We need some, like, sleigh bells. Can we add some sleigh
bells? Sleigh bells? Okay, here. Oh, that's nice. How about a fire? We need a roaring fire.
Ooh, crackling fire.
Cool. What else?
We need some hose.
Excuse me?
No, like Santa hose.
Oh, hose. That makes more sense. Okay, how about these? Here. All right, how about like a blowing, windy snowstorm?
Ooh.
Okay, here.
Okay, people ripping presents open.
Oh, nice. Okay, and Christmas carols, like, you know, going door to door.
Okay.
I wonder if we overdid things a bit.
I can't even hear the music.
Okay, that's enough. Maybe there's too much of a good thing. Wow, we burned all the intro time. Should we just start?
Okay.
Hang on one sec. Morgan, the coffee's in the green room. Wait there and we'll get you when we need you. Jeez, what a prima donna. This is our technically fifth holiday episode. I say technically because the first, I am still emotionally scarred by what you did without telling me. You sent me the final version, and you said, I hope you like this.
So for those of you who were not with us in the first season, I recorded, I don't know what it was called, like Jiffy's Special Christmas or something. But yeah, Patrick had no knowledge of this. I just sent it to him. And the best part for me was that you sent me a picture of yourself with headphones on with tears coming down your face while you were listening. And that made it all worthwhile for me.
Hi. This is Jiffy, the new Quantitude intern. We have something really special for Q-Pod listeners this holiday season. It's a dramatic Quantitude version of the classic poem, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
My favorite was somebody posted on Twitter, just one post, and it said, what the hell was that? So, welcome.
You love the holidays, right?
It's my favorite. I play trumpet, and so I get to play all over the place doing different kind of holiday music. Now, we have also established on prior episodes, you are not such a lover of the holidays.
Yeah, I'm not. I would actually choose an advent calendar that gets me past Christmas, even past New Year, just getting on the other side and getting it all over with.
Now, I'm going to go out on a limb, and generalizing from that, I bet you don't like holiday movies either.
I mean, they're sort of in celebration of something I don't particularly enjoy.
Oh, that's true. It's like having a whole series of movies that talk about root canals.
I'm your dentist, and I get off on the pain I inflict.
But what's weird is I am not a terribly sentimental guy.
That's right.
I have my holiday spiked jacket on now. Notice it's red and it keeps people from hugging me.
It's nice. Tasteful.
I am uncharacteristically sentimental about holiday movies.
Yeah.
Are we amongst friends here? Can I share a little bit of my soul? Because this is truly embarrassing, given that I'm wearing my spiked jacket.
I was not aware you had a soul.
I found a little shred of something in the corner of my psyche, and I'm calling that a soul.
All right. What do you got?
Love Actually. I watch that movie every year. It is sappy.
Mm-hmm.
About half the people you talk to despise it. I love that movie.
Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, I think about the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport. General opinion starting to make out that we live in a world of hatred and greed. But I don't see that. Seems to me that love is everywhere. If you look for it, I've got a sneaky feeling you'll find that love actually is all around.
That's interesting.
My little shred of soul got a little bit smaller right there. I saw it over in the corner.
And his soul shrank 3 sizes that day.
Now, let's be clear. This does not mean I do not like Bad Santa.
Where's your sleigh?
It's in the shop.
Where are the reindeer?
I stable them.
Where's the stable?
Next to the shop.
How do they sleep?
Are you f***ing with me?
Is that the spirit of the holidays for you then?
So it's so weird. So Love Actually, Bad Santa. I love A Muppet Christmas Carol with Gonzo and Rizzo the Rat.
Michael Caine.
If you please, Mr. Scrooge, it's gotten colder. Yeah. Any bookkeeping staff would like to have an extra shovel full of coal?
How would the bookkeepers like to be suddenly...
I have an eclectic mix of holiday movies. Now, throw me a bone. There must be out in the corpus of holiday movies something that represents the season for you.
Mm-hmm. Die Hard.
But give me a holiday movie.
Die Hard is totally a holiday movie, and it is the thing that warms the cockles of my heart. I don't even know what cockles are.
Okay, so for the entire generation of people who were not raised on Die Hard, give me a 30-second synopsis of the movie.
All right,
I'll give it a shot. Cue the music.
John McClane is a grizzled New York cop visiting his wife who took a job in L.A. at Nakatomi Plaza. Little does he know that that building is about to be commandeered by 12 angry terrorists, led by Hans Gruber. So it is up to John McClane to save his wife, to save Nakatomi Plaza, and to save Christmas.
And to have really cool taglines that he says throughout.
That's right.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother
Now, I have a question and a clarification.
Okay.
The question is, were there really 12 terrorists, or did you make that up?
I thought there were 12, but I don't actually know.
Okay, because that would have been a really nice, like, 12 days of Christmas, 12 golden terrorists. Okay. And then the clarification, because this is important background. He's actually estranged from his wife, and he's trying to get back together. So you got to put that in, because this movie is like multiple layers of emotional complexity.
Oh, it absolutely has layers.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring except the four assholes coming in the rear in standard 2x2 cover formation.
And I know that scholars have debated whether technically it's a Christmas movie or not a Christmas movie.
Now I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho.
And I don't care.
I kid you not. Last night, I was at the North Carolina Symphony for their holiday pop show, which I love and go to every year. Mm-hmm. And the conductor had a selection from The Nightmare Before Christmas.
There's children throwing snowballs instead of throwing heads. They're busy building toys, and absolutely no one's dead.
He literally turned to the audience and said, Nightmare Before Christmas is a Halloween movie. And the principal violinist said, well, let's replace it with Die Hard. And in front of like 800 people, they have this conversation, and the conductor said, fine, we'll do that next time.
Next year.
So I understand this is like stitched into the fabric of society.
Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. It's a goddamn Bruce Willis movie.
I'm actually not taking a stand one way or the other. I'm drawn to why an action movie where people get shot and blown up and thrown off of high-rise buildings represents the holidays for you.
You won't hurt me.
Yeah? Why not?
Because you're a policeman. There are rules for policemen.
Yeah. So my captain keeps telling me.
contrary to popular belief, I actually am a clinical psychologist. All right, now we've established I'm a really horrible, horrible clinical psychologist.
Uh-huh.
I am going to spend the remainder of this episode gathering data so that I can develop a theory as to why Die Hard represents the holiday spirit for you.
Okay, because I honestly, I don't know if I could articulate it. I just know, believe it or not, it makes me feel good.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
Now, you and I, over 140 episodes, have demonstrated a preternatural ability to take anything at all, and make it quantitative.
Yes, we have.
I want you to take your favorite holiday movie and pivot into a quantitative conversation.
Okay. All right, here we go. This is actually, it's so obvious, I'm embarrassed.
Who are you, then?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. The pain in the ass.
In quantitative methods, there are a lot of ideas that just won't die. Huh?
Okay, that works really well.
Thank you.
Now, compare that to your ridiculous justification for somehow you had haiku with team science. I don't even remember that pounding a square peg into a round hole.
Okay, I don't know what you're talking about.
Ideas that die hard, you get an attaboy for that one.
Well, thank you.
Despite all attempts by so many people out in the quantitative world, these ideas just need to be taken to the top of a skyscraper on Christmas Eve and thrown off.
That's not a hostage.
Merry Christmas, Greg.
All right, so I will start.
Before you do, I'm going to start my data gathering. I'm going to give you sample movies that no reasonable person would dislike.
Okay.
A Charlie Brown Christmas. This is lovely. This is touching. This is warm. It ends with all the kids singing around the tree. Give me one reason why you would not like this movie.
Do you know how they treat Charlie Brown? Do you know what they call Charlie Brown the whole time throughout?
You've been dumb before, Charlie Brown, but this time you really did it.
Are the adults any help at any point? No, they just go, wah, 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 wah. They do nothing. You can't just wrap a blanket around that and everything is going to be okay.
Okay, just a sec. I'm taking a few notes here. All right, you start us out. Hans Gruber has come into the building.
And when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer.
Right, so I have a feeling that the ideas that we're going to mention here are things that you and I have poked at different points over the last 140 episodes, but that's kind of the point, right? That these things absolutely won't die. And I was reviewing a manuscript 2 weeks ago, and the authors said, you know, they were sort of bragging a little bit that they did an a priori power analysis, a sample size determination. And I value thoughtful planning completely. Whatever I'm about to say, do not let that get lost in the shuffle. But when they told me that the power was going to be 0.82 for the thing that they wanted to test, I did not believe that for 1 second. Let's think about this. A power of 0.82. I'm not even going to get into the fact that there's power for many things usually that we're testing, but let's imagine we're testing one slope in a regression. Fine, you got a regression and you care about that slope. God bless you. There are all kinds of assumptions that we know exist in regression, right? There's assumption of residual normality. There's an assumption of independence of observations, et cetera, et cetera. 0.82 power might be what you would get if you met every one of those particular assumptions. But you know what? You twiddle the knob on any of those and 0.82 goes out the window. And sometimes it goes out the window just a little bit and your actual power might be 0.81 or 0.84 or 0.78. And sometimes it goes out the window just hard. Like you fail to meet an assumption and now you're talking 0.7 or 0.65. But, oh, I'm not done yet. That assumes that you even got the effect size correct in the first place, right? Because whenever you're doing a power analysis, an a priori power analysis, you have to say, well, how big an effect do I want to detect? Let's say you say 0.3. Well, what if the beta weight isn't actually 0.3? What if it's 0.25? Well, there goes your power. But I looked at the literature and got this 0.3 for that particular slope. Oh, did you? Did the literature have the same population? Did the literature have the same measures? Did the literature have the same other variables in the model? And oh, by the way, about those other variables in the model, you might only care about that particular path in a regression, but if you have other covariates in the model, the relations that those covariates have with your predictor, with the outcome, that matters. So even if you nailed that 0.3, damn it, it is 0.3. And if you've met every assumption under the sun, what's going on contextually around your magic 0.3 can make your power drop precipitously. Again, it doesn't mean it's a bad idea to plan. It's just a bad idea to brag about some power value you have because you cannot know with precision. And for whatever reason, this idea will not die.
I love that. I think that should be the first terrorist to go.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
I love the clarification that it's not a bad idea to plan. And indeed, that's one of the most important ideas we have. It's critical. It's fundamental to what we do. But that notion that your power is 0.828 is absurd. And people cling to that like the floating door in Titanic. They can clearly hold two people.
Sorry, Jack.
And she's hogging the whole thing herself as Jack's frozen solid body sinks out of view.
Jack. Jack.
And he is having a better Christmas than I do. I think a wise person once said, no, I'm wrong. It was you who once said we might as well just use emojis because of the pseudo-precision associated with this.
You are referring to early days where I did advocate for emojis, which was a smiley face, a straight face, a frowny face, and an eggplant.
Wait, there's a poop emoji in
there,
too.
Yeah, but that really is when you build in confidence intervals, when you build in sampling variability, when you take in all the features that you described. You either have a smiley face or a straight face. Or, you know, what we could work in is a little shrug. So I like that. So I'm going to replace it, all right?
Okay.
Smiley face, the shrug, and then a poop emoji. And that you're okay if you have the shrug. It's like, yeah.
Okay.
I do remember, and I'm being serious about this for a moment, it was the most angry my grad advisor ever was with me. She was doing a really important grant application. She was incredibly careful and rigorous in everything that she did in all of her work. And I had done hours of power analysis.
Yep.
And she stopped me in the hallway in the building and she said, good news, we revised it a little bit to add 8 more families to the 400 and some. Can you update the power estimates? Trying to be funny, as I said, can I just give you the value now or do you want me to wait an hour and give it to you then?
But all things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
But it's just that, right? Is 0.82? Yeah. Sure. Let's just go with 0.83. Yeah. Smiley face, shrug, poop emoji. Okay. Now, as I continue to gather data to understand the psyche that you call your head.
Okay.
I'm going to give you another movie. Home Alone.
Oh.
A kid appreciates the value of family. He helps the neighbor next door reconcile with his estranged son. And most important to everything, the entire thing is inexplicably scored by John Williams.
Did he hit a rough patch?
I don't know if his Porsche needed fixing or if that's when his cocaine habit was really getting out of hand. Quantitude International and all of its affiliates, both domestic and abroad, are in no way implying that John Williams was having or ever did have a cocaine problem, leading him to score Home Alone. But you do have to admit that it's hard to explain otherwise. Home Alone. What can possibly be wrong with that?
How about one word? Abandonment? What? How much do these parents love their child that they forgot their child and went away?
How could we do this? We forgot him.
We didn't forget him. We just miscounted.
What kind of mother am I?
It makes you feel any better.
I forgot my reading glasses.
Oh, but it gets better. You know what's even more messed up? When Kevin woke up and found that his parents were gone, he thought that his prayers had been answered. This is no holiday movie. This is trauma scored by John Williams.
Okay, I have to make a few notes here about that dark, dark place you call your psyche. All right, I have had a chance to travel a lot this fall. As part of my wandering around, I happened to see a senior person and I went in to hear them present. I was just out and about and I thought this would be fun. Mm-hmm. They were a quantitatively oriented substantive researcher, very well trained and very esteemed in their quantitative writing. I kid you not, as they were presenting findings, they had a p-value that was less than 0.001, and they literally said, we can take this as evidence that it is highly unlikely that the null hypothesis is true. Mm. All right, let me say that again. Because of the small p-value, it is highly unlikely that the null hypothesis is true. All right. This goes back more than a century.
Yeah.
That people have been talking about this. Books have been written about this. Papers. I mean, ad nauseum. So let's think super briefly. What is a probability? A probability is a ratio where in the numerator is the frequency of the event that you're interested in. And in the denominator is the total possible number of events. Mm-hmm. That is unconditional. We're not bringing any information to bear.
Yep.
All right. What is all of null hypothesis testing? Well, it's conditional probability. What is the probability it's going to snow today? Right? That's unconditional. I haven't given you any information. What's the probability it's going to snow today given that it is July 15th? Right? That's a conditional probability.
Uh-huh.
We can calculate the probability of event given information. All of null hypothesis testing, as we do as frequentists, what is the probability I would have observed this difference in my sample means given there was no difference in the population? That is the probability. Now, if the probability is less than 0.05, we say there is less than a 5% chance I would have observed my sample mean difference at this value or greater if there was really no difference in the population. All right, that interpretation given by a senior quantitative person in front of 100 people in the room flipped probability of A given B to the probability of B given A.
Yep.
And this is where all of Bayesian statistics comes from. What we have is the probability of our data given the null. How we tend to interpret it is the probability of the null given the data. That's what Jack Cohen called the Bayesian fallacy.
Yep.
And that is Hans Gruber, who needs to be pitched out a window.
Happy trails, Hans.
The whole p-value thing is just plain difficult for people, and I don't know how else to say it. There was a lovely discussion about this issue by another podcast, Nullius in Verba. Our friends Daniel and Smriti had an episode, I think it was episode 10, where they talked a lot about p-values and probabilities and null hypothesis testing, all of that. So, I mean, there's a larger issue about whether or not we should be doing this type of hypothesis testing, and that's an important conversation to have. But something as fundamental as the p-value, there are like 8 different ways I explained it, and none of them seem to take. I don't know what to do about that. I don't know how to correct this problem, but the misinterpretations of the p-value need to die. If we're going to use p-values, they need to die, but I don't know what to do about it.
Fisher, Neiman, Pearson, going back to the earliest days,
yeah.
People have talked about this. A recommendation I have, there is a wonderful quantitative researcher at Arizona State University, Samantha Anderson.
Yeah.
We've had her on as a guest and talked about reproducibility and replicability. And she has a lovely paper in 2019 in Psych Methods that the first part of it, I don't have the full title, but the first part of it is Misinterpreting P. It walks through step by step of what's going on. She introduces multiplicity into it of what if you're doing multiple tests. She does a simulation. And she has a wonderful term at the end where she's talking about like one of the main things in the paper is why can't we get our head around it?
Mm-hmm.
She says at one point, the p-value is wearing a clever disguise.
Hmm.
There's that p-value. We did all our work. We gathered all our data. We did all our statistical modeling, and we get a p that's less than 0.05. Surely this is more interpretable than just what's the probability I would have observed my mean difference if there was not a difference in the population.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
So if you're interested in drilling into this a bit, I highly recommend Samantha's paper. I think it's just wonderful.
Nice.
All right.
I'm worried you're going to probe my psyche now, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'll probe next. Sure.
I can see you gloving up in your eyes.
I will. Let me take this off here. All right. Yes, I am going to probe your psyche.
Okay.
I'm going to bring up one of my favorite movies of all time, in part because of the movie, but also in part because of the actor who is a hero of mine, Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart is an utterly remarkable human being, an incredible actor. He also walked away at the peak of his career to sign up for the Air Force when World War II broke out. He became a pilot of a B-24 Liberator. He won 2 Flying Crosses for bravery in his service. Part of my love of this movie is just that he's in it. But obviously, I'm talking about It's a Wonderful Life. It talks about families. It talks about values. It talks about communities. Of course, the final scene of the jingling bells is...
That's right.
Go ahead. Somehow you're going to take a shovel and go out into the cemetery and dig up some corpse for why you don't like this movie.
I don't want to get dark here. I don't want to bring down the whole holiday mood. So let me just sum up It's a Wonderful Life. It is 130 minutes trying to convince a guy not to kill himself. That's it. The movie starts with him pondering suicide, all of the people that he believes that he has let down in life. It takes freaking angels to
try. A pretty incompetent angel. I mean, let's clarify. This is not like a third degree black belt angel. This is like a kind of a fumbling angel.
They sent down like the Walmart of angels.
Looks like we'll have to send someone down. A lot of people asking for help for a man named George Bailey.
Whose turn is it?
It's a clockmaker's turn again.
Oh, Clarence hasn't got his wings yet, has he?
Because, you know, sir, he's got the IQ of a rabbit.
To try to convince this guy that his life had value.
How did you happen to fall in?
I didn't fall in. I jumped in to save George.
To save me?
Well, I did, didn't I? You didn't go through with it, did you? Go
through with what?
Suicide.
I don't know. I think it's kind of a depressing premise, and that was hard for me to get past.
Okay, that one I'll give you. That is kind of the core of the entire movie. But you have to admit, Jimmy Stewart is pretty damn cool.
Oh, he's great. He's one of my favorite actors. No question.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Now I need your next idea that needs to die.
So you were at a talk recently? I was at a talk recently. I was at a talk this fall. It was in an entirely different field that shall remain nameless. But one of the things that I learned by going to talks in other fields is sort of, and this is going to sound so pejorative, but where they are in their evolution methodologically.
Wow, that is pejorative.
It's just fascinating to see how stupid different fields are. That's not how I meant it.
And you and I still don't understand why no one likes us.
I don't get it. But anyway, so in this work, they were talking about how they were very happy to have not found any relations between certain variables. Now, forget about the whole idea about proving a null. That's a conversation for another day. But the measures that they had as part of this study, there was absolutely no comment on the quality of those measures. Now, when you come over to psychology, you come over to education, you come over to the social sciences, one of the first things we ask is about the quality of the measures that you have, both in terms of validity and reliability. Let's just focus on reliability for right now. You go to other fields, and the notion of reliability, it's just sort of, at best, this vague term that you use that isn't very concrete. They just come up with their own measures left and right without any care as to whether or not those measures themselves are reliable. And so I'm listening to this talk, and I'm not the guy who speaks out, who raises his hand very often in talks, and I didn't in this case. But it was just fascinating to me how they had their own measures. They were honestly really crappy measures. So there was no way those measures were reliable and no way they had any fighting chance of having a relation. Now, that's sort of one end of the continuum where the idea of reliability is not even something you're concerned with. A little bit farther down the continuum are people who know that reliability is something that's important, but they believe that that has been somehow established in some other study, right? So you ask them, tell me about the quality of your measures, and they go, previous work has shown that they're reliable. Inside me, I'm always like, well, what about that previous work? Is that previous work that was done in this century with a population like you have? Instruments are a bookmark in time, right? They're created at a certain point, and you hope that there's longevity to those things and that they will continue to apply. But depending on what it is you're measuring, you might find that some of those items are no longer interpreted the same way, whether for linguistic reasons, for cultural reasons, for contextual reasons. Reliability is an ongoing process. So the idea that needs to die hard here, I think, is that the reliability of your measures are something you don't have to be concerned with in the context of your study.
I love that one. The very notion of proven reliability is like an oxymoron. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. We're not going to get into it in a future episode. It'd be fun to dig into like classical test theory. We already did a reliability episode. See, I knew. I remembered that. I remembered that we did an episode.
Impressive.
Greg and I were talking, and I came up with this really funny idea to finish the episode with, and Greg roared with laughter, and I thought, awesome, I came up with a really funny idea, and when he stopped laughing, he said, you know, that's how we ended last year's episode. Where are my car keys? Oh, I'm holding them. Anyway, you can think about reliability as a characteristic of a sample.
Mm-hmm.
We can contrast that to item response theory, where under certain assumptions, it's a characteristic of the assessment itself.
Mm-hmm.
So to even say the words reliability has been proven is just a fundamental misstatement of what reliability is. But regardless, that is an idea that needs to... I like how you even did the die hard.
Well, thank you.
Okay, I have a last movie that I'm going to ask as I'm continuing to develop my psychoanalytic theory. I was trained as a cognitive behaviorist, but I think that is woefully underpowered to deal with the darkness of your psyche. I don't know what the actual name of it is, but Rudolph. You have this lovely little fawn who has this red nose and then has some adventures and then saves Christmas.
That beautiful, wonderful nose. Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?
It will be an honor, sir.
Give me one issue that you have with that.
I can't. I can't give you just one. So I'm going to...
Oh, wait. I walked right into that.
Where to begin? Rudolph, who is different from the others, is relentlessly mocked, not allowed to play the reindeer games.
For crying out loud!
Fireball, what's the matter?
Get away! Get away from me!
Hey, look at the beast!
Hey, fire snow!
Fireball, pause!
Right now!
Stop calling me names!
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer!
And you know where he feels most at home? On an island of misfit toys, which is basically a leper colony for toys that no one wants. That's where he feels at home, right? Those are his people.
How would you like to be a spotted elephant?
Or a choo-choo with square wheels on your caboose?
Or a water pistol that shoots jelly?
We're all misfits.
And the end credits of Rudolph. This is very subtle, and I noticed this when I was a kid. They are distributing the misfit toys to help them all find homes. Great. So Santa's sleigh is flying around, and each of the little toys is given an umbrella to float down to a home to find a loving child. There's the dolly. There's the squirt gun. There's also a bird. It's a bird that doesn't fly, though.
How would you like to be a bird that doesn't fly? I swim.
The bird is up there in the sleigh, and the elf, who is handing umbrellas to the toys so they can float down to the homes, grabs an umbrella, looks at the bird, looks at the umbrella, but then just tosses the bird out, thinking it's a bird.
Who can't fly?
The bird who can't. So I am a child watching this. I'm screaming at the TV, he can't fly! He can't fly! So the very end of the show is a misfit plummeting to its death. What's wrong with Rudolph?
Okay, listeners, I think we're starting to sketch out Greg's thinking in the holiday season. All right, let me make a few notes. Mm-hmm. Okay, the last one I'm going to go out on is an article I reviewed just a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. They did an SEM. They did it well, and they were careful, and they laid out their model, and they justified it theoretically. It was pretty complicated. And the only piece of information they gave was an RMSEA that was equal to 0.052. Mm. They didn't give any other indices. They didn't give a confidence interval on the RMSEA. They said it was 0.052, indicating that this was a poor fit to the characteristics of the sample data. They looked at modification indices. They added some parameters. They re-estimated the model, and they got an RMSEA of 0.049. And they said this indicated that this was a good fitting model, and moved to the discussion section. Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned last night I went to see the symphony. I actually went as a bachelor. My wife had a thing that she couldn't get out of. The kids are back at college. And so I went out for dinner by myself. Mm-hmm. I actually had a lovely time with myself. I'm the only person who I can tolerate in a social setting. And I had my clipboard and my fountain pen and my phone. And I looked up three quotes so that I could have them at my fingertips this morning. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about P less than 0.05 R.A. Fisher. All right. 1925, this is the actual quote. The value for which P equals 0.05, or 1 in 20, is 1.96, or nearly 2. He was talking about standard errors. It is convenient to take this point as a limit in judging whether a deviation ought to be considered significant or not. And then as Salzberg, who is a historian, noted, he was using significant not in the way we use today, but that it's potentially meaningful. Mm-hmm. All right, so look at that. A 1 in 20 is convenient to take this as a point of judging. Mm-hmm. Now let's move to Bentler and Bonnet. All right, Bentler and Bonnet presented the CFI. 26,000 citations, of which I think 25,998 of them are incorrect, because people say the CFI exceeded 0.9, indicating good model fit. All right, folks, I'm going to read the actual words. In our experience, models with overall fit indices less than 0.9 can usually be improved substantially. Hmm. Can you just take the complement of that and say, therefore, values exceeding 0.9 indicate good fit? No, there is no element of that sentence that says values over 0.9 indicate good fit. It says values less than 0.9 can usually be improved upon. Brown and Kudak, 1992. All right, we're talking the most recent one that I'm citing here is 31 years ago. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about ideas that die hard, okay, ready, folks? Practical experience has made us feel that a value of the RMSEA of about 0.05 or less would indicate a close fit of the model in relation to the degrees of freedom.
Feel.
You and I don't experience feelings, but I read a pamphlet my wife gave me once that other people do.
Huh.
That a value of the RMSEA, okay, folks, of about 0.05.
Yeah.
There is no basis in statistics in general, but in the SEM in particular, that we have these hard and fixed cutoffs that your model does or does not fit.
Yeah.
Remember the pirate code?
The code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules.
We have to take a holistic approach to the evaluation of our models. And we look at chi-squares and degrees of freedom and p-value and CFI and TLI and the RMSEA. We look at the residuals between the observed and implied covariance matrix and mean vectors. We look at modification indices or Lagrange multipliers. And then, heaven forbid, we remind ourselves of the horse we rode into town on being theory. So the Hans Gruber that needs to be chucked out the window that I'm going to end with is that there are clear-cut points for anything we do.
And this is a very frustrating thing for quantitative people, right? We are people who like rules, who follow standards, but there's no way that we can cut off our way out of thinking.
Which leads me to the psychoanalytic theory that I've developed. Throughout this conversation, I now understand why Die Hard is the quintessential holiday movie for you. Would you like me to share this with you?
No, but I know that's not going to stop you.
No, it is not.
No, I'm ready. I'm lying on your psychoanalytic holiday couch.
It's the holiday time. You're not home with your family. You're away because of choices your parents have made. Nakatomi Plaza is that place away from home where you are. Where you go during the holidays in trying to regain some kind of semblance of your family. The plaza is decorated up for the holidays, but you're there and it just feels foreign to you. I mean, you're almost a stranger there. The building has this appearance of safety and strength, but it's made entirely of glass. People can see through glass. People can see through you. Hans Gruber, he has a band of 11 Euro terrorists. I'm going to double down on the 12 terrorists, Days of Christmas. Okay. La, 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 la. Nope, different song. Anyway, 11 Euro terrorists. Those are the forces outside your control. You came, you walked in, you did not know this was going to happen. They're unpredictable. They're cruel. These are the challenges that you have to triumph in. Who are you? You're not an action hero. You're vulnerable. You're fallible. You're forced to run barefoot across the broken glass of your childhood. But you do rise, challenging the turmoil of the war of your own competing inner egos in order to reclaim some sense of family, even if at the cost of the last semblance of innocence lost along the way.
Huh. Nah, I think I just like movies where people blow shit up. But I'm sure your analysis was really good.
You'll get my bill in the mail. Okay. Now, I got to tell you, 3 or 4 times in the last hour, Morgan has come in looking for coffee. He wants a donut. He ate a dozen freaking donuts. I have a proposal. Mm-hmm. I think we should sketch out our holiday sentiments to one another and have Morgan read them for us. And that's how we'll wrap up the holiday episode. What do you say?
Deal.
Morgan! Get in here! We need you!
I haven't seen him. I'm not sure where he is.
What exactly are we getting for our $100?
I'm not exactly sure, actually.
I'm actually a little worried. Didn't you stock the green room with eggnog?
Oh, my.
Come with me, buddy.
I'm nervous.
Okay, shh, shh, shh.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle bells.
Dude, are they drunk?
Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
That was very good. Would you like some more eggnog?
Hit me, Shawshank.
How did you make that amazing sound when you were singing?
Lemurs have 2 tongues. Look. Ah.
Whoa.
Cool, huh?
So how about if you use one of those tongues to tell me some good dirt on Patrick and Greg?
They had me sign a non-disclosure agreement. And if you heard half the stuff that they have to edit out, you would understand why.
Well, how about another holiday song, then?
How about Rudolph? I think Greg likes that one.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Okay, well, so much for $100 of fake holiday cheer to each other. Are we going to have to actually tell each other something?
I won't if you won't.
It feels like we gotta. I mean, the whole Love Actually thing and hugging in the airport and stuff.
You got a spike jacket on, right?
I... razor sharp.
All right, I'll go first. Ready?
All right. Yeah.
Happy holidays, buddy.
Yeah, whatever. See you on the other side. Yeah.